meeting tonight. We meet every second and fourth Tuesday from September to May, with a couple of exceptions. Last one in December we don't, last one in May we don't. Let's see, I want to remind you to please tip your server. Philosophy is not free, we always say, and if you haven't paid, David Drum over here will be glad to take $5. I guess that's about all I have to say. Dr. Brad Thompson is going to be our speaker tonight, and he is a professor of philosophy at Southern Methodist University. He specializes in philosophy of mind. He was born in Paris, Texas, went to school in Rice for his undergraduate, and then moved out to Arizona, University of Arizona, to get his PhD in philosophy. Tonight he's going to be speaking on pleasure as an attitude, if I remember correctly. So please welcome Dr. Brad Harris.
And I'm not used to, is this working?
Yeah, it's working, yes. Yeah.
Great. Can anyone hear me? Hopefully.
Yeah, I'll take care of it. Just keep talking.
Okay, well, why don't I just get started? The first, top of the handout, I read a few claims that I'm going to try to argue for, and I'm not the best about knowing, it's not even more than I can actually do in the amount of time we have, so. one claim that might seem extremely uncontroversial, but as we're going to see, has turned out to be a matter of debate, is that pleasure makes a contribution to the overall phenomenology of an experience. And by that I mean that there's something that it feels like to be experiencing pleasure, and it makes a contribution to what it's like for you at a time. Another argument, another thing I'm going to argue for is that pleasure is not merely a feeling or sensation, but a certain kind of pro-attitude directed towards some object or proposition. And I'll say some more about what I mean by pro-attitude. Thirdly, I'm going to argue that the attitude of pleasure isn't reducible to desire, although it is closely related to desire. Another thing that I may not talk about as much, but that I put here is that pleasure, the way I think about pleasure right now is that pleasure tells us what to want, or ground is a source, sort of involuntary ground for things that are worth wanting, in a way that's similar to the way that perception is an involuntary source of things worth believing. So pleasure in seeing something that can be a source of then a belief or ground a judgment about the world. And pleasure is sort of doing a similar role, but with respect to desire. And finally, at the end, I'd like to talk about the idea that the objects of pleasure are the objects of perception in the sensory case, or the objects of thought in the case of intellectual pleasures, rather than the sensations or thoughts themselves. Again, I'll explain that as we go along. So to start off with, when I first started thinking about pleasure, I think I had a certain view, and I don't know if this is universal, but just if you haven't thought about pleasure philosophically, but we've all experienced pleasures, pains, and we have a sort of common sense idea about it. I think I often thought of it as just a simple feeling, right? It's just sort of a good feeling, right? There's to feel pleasure, a certain kind of sensation or feeling that is caused by other things that happen to you. So maybe suppose you're getting a back rub and then you feel pleasure. There's the tactile experience of the back rub, and then that somehow causes this feeling of pleasure. But we can call it, if you like, that a felt quality theory, which says that if you ask what is pleasure, the answer is, well, it's a certain kind of feeling. Maybe it's hard to describe that feeling, but anyone who's had that feeling sort of knows what it is. But this view has turned out to be sort of one of the least popular views in contemporary philosophy, and largely because of what's called the heterogeneity problem. And that is that in reflecting about the different experiences of pleasure that you might have, many have argued that there is no single feeling that's associated with pleasure. There's no introspectively identifiable feeling of pleasure at all. So compare, I have this on the handout, compare a few examples. So compare the pleasure of eating fresh pineapple and think about what that's like. Mm-hmm. And then think about the pleasure of listening to music The pleasure of orgasm. It is Valentine's Day. the pleasure of reading a good book. The pleasure of a back massage, or maybe the pleasure of solving a difficult puzzle. So these are all just examples of experiences we might have that we might say are pleasurable. And what a lot of philosophers, and actually I think this argument goes back to the ethicist Sidgwick, have observed that when you introspect on each of these different examples of pleasure, philosophers have often claimed they can't find the feeling of pleasure itself, or they can't find a common element that all these things have in common. They're heterogeneous. They're all different. They're all pleasure, but they all feel different. And this is meant to cast suspicion on the idea that there really is a feeling of pleasure. Now I'm going to criticize that argument in a little bit. But in its place, those who have given this sort of argument have used it to motivate what we could call an attitude theory. But in particular, the attitude they focus on is desire. So I have a few quotes on the handout just to sort of show you different things that people have said in response to this observation. So Derek Parfit, 1984, in a really important book. Here's a quote. He says, "What pains and pleasures have in common are their relations to our desires. On the use of pain, which has rational and moral significance, all pains are, when experienced, unwanted. And a pain is worse or greater the more it is unwanted. Similarly, all pleasures are, when experienced, wanted, and they are better or greater the more they are wanted." Carson, 2000, "The motivational theory of pleasure is the view that the pleasantness or unpleasantness of an experience is a function of one's desires with respect to it, qua feeling. A pleasant experience is an experience that one prefers to have rather than not to have, abstracting from all considerations about its consequences and preconditions. The motivational theory provides a plausible account of what all of the many different kinds of pleasures, many different kinds of experiences we call pleasures, have in common." So in other words, what do all these pleasures have in common? Well, here's the one thing they have in common. They're sensations or experiences that we want to be having. And Heathwood takes this, and actually he's, I think, the clearest, giving it, he actually has a paper called The Sensory Reduction of Pleasure, the reduction of sensory pleasure to desire. And here's his reduction. So he says, "A sensation S occurring at time T is a sensory pleasure at T if and only if the subject of S desires intrinsically and de re at T of S that it be occurring." So in other words, if you're having an experience of pleasure right now, maybe you ate some cheesy enchiladas and you enjoyed the taste, what makes that a pleasure? On this view, it's not that there's an extra feeling beyond the taste of the cheese, the taste of the tortillas, the taste of whatever's inside. Rather, you're having a gustatory experience, and you want to be having it, and so it's a pleasure, right? So that's the sense in which these views are kind of reductive. They're reducing pleasure to something else, namely being the object of a certain kind of desire. And they're denying that there's any, this is motivated again by the heterogeneity problem, is finding that there is no common phenomenal element. Okay, so that's the heterogeneity problem and how it's been used to motivate a sort of attitude view. And so very few philosophers, but some do, adopt a view that feeling pleasure is a feeling. It's rather some kind of attitude. But here the attitude is actually desire, right? The relation of desire that you can have towards an experience is what makes it a pleasure. So first I want to try to argue that this is not a good argument, I think, for the attitude theory insofar as it rejects the idea that there is a distinctive phenomenal feel or associated with pleasure. And I'll give a few examples to try to support this, or at least one general phenomenon, which is to reflect on something that's called alesthesia. We've actually all experienced this. So I've got a quote here from a neuroscientist, Kavanagh, who I actually think he's the first person that's really drew a lot of attention to this. "The amount of pleasure or displeasure aroused by a given stimulus is not invariable. It depends on the internal state of the stimulated subject." So alesthesia is supposed to be this general phenomenon where the same stimulus, say the same visual stimulus, the same auditory stimulus, the same gustatory stimulus, like food, that the pleasure that you feel in response to that stimulus can vary depending on factors internal to you. So here's one example that I think we've all experienced. I've got here an example one. Compare the first slice of pizza to the last slice of pizza, or maybe the first nacho or to the last nacho or something like that, right, since we're having Tex-Mex. It seems to me that there's a sense in which what I mean by the first slice is you're hungry, and you eat that first slice of pizza, and it tastes delicious. And maybe you're not yet full, and you have a second slice. Now, if you're like me, there might come a point where you're full. In fact, you might even be stuffed, but you eat another slice anyways, which is, or maybe you're just about to be pretty full, and you have that left. Maybe there's one slice left, and you're like, well, I'm going to waste it. And it seems to me that introspectively, the way that slice tastes is different than the first slice. And maybe in the Q&A, I'd be curious if you agree with me about that. Now, I think this is the neuroscientist that I quoted. I mean, I think this is meant to be kind of uncontroversial, actually, and it's something that they sort of test. Now, if pleasure did not contribute, so I think this change is a change in pleasure. And so what I'm trying to do here is actually to point to an example where we might try to identify the contribution that pleasure makes to your phenomenal experience, like the way your experience is like. So it's not as though the last slice tastes different with respect to its saltiness or its sweetness or or the other sort of gustatory qualities. I think that would be strange, right? It seems as though you're sort of tasting, the pizza is of course the same. I'm assuming that you don't like it because it's not that you just like it. You like it less because it got cold. I mean, imagine that everything's kept constant. Something's changed. It seems to me, it doesn't seem like it's a change in the sort of gustatory representation that representation of the various flavors that the food has. So I think this is a change in pleasure. Another example would be something that you might experience after a bout of food poisoning. An acquired aversion. So this happened to me, I don't remember, just a year ago, I think I got food poisoning, and that morning I wasn't sure what caused it, but that morning I'd had eggs, and I developed an aversion to eggs, which I'm still a little bit, like, I used to love eggs, but now, in studying this, one of the things that's, so I might say more about that example in just a second. But to make this point about trying to identify a phenomenal contribution, I mean, suppose I used to like eggs. Now, let's say I don't. It's not that, so I would say that when I eat the eggs, there's a change. My experience is very different now that I have this aversion to the eggs. But it's not that it's changed the way the eggs taste in the sense of sort of my ability to sense various features in the eggs. The change, again, I'm trying to point towards is a change that I think is the phenomenology of pleasure. So if we were to go back to the heterogeneity problem, the observation was supposed to be that there's lots of different pleasurable experiences can vary in many ways, right? The pleasure of back rub is different from the pleasure of solving a puzzle or eating fresh pineapple. This is consistent with that. So to say that pleasure is a phenomenology doesn't mean it's sort of standalone feeling that floats freely from the rest of your experiences. There is this sense in which there's some kind of commingling of going on, so each experience of pleasure might be different because there's some differing elements, say the back rub versus solving a difficult puzzle. But this common element, there's something that changes that pleasure is a pleasure change, right? Some kind of phenomenal change in your experience that's due to pleasure. So that's a reason, I think, to reject the idea that pleasure has no phenomenology. Now, what about the attitude theory? So in section 5 here, I say attitude or feeling. And one thing that's and this is a little bit of the history of 20th century philosophy of mind, a point that I could make here, which is that often in much of the 20th century, Mental states were divided between those in their sort of taxonomy. Mental states that have a phenomenal character, a phenomenology, again, by that I mean that they feel a certain way. So sensory experiences, or something like to see a color or to hear a sound. And these were uncontroversially states that have a phenomenology. And then there's other mental states like belief or desire being the most prominent ones, these cognitive states. And their characteristic traits is normally understood to be the fact that they have what philosophers call intentionality, where they're, and we could say representation, they're about something. They represent something outside. And often it was often assumed that beliefs and desires don't have phenomenology. And it was often assumed that perceptual experiences only have phenomenology. So this sort of, there's a classic view that you might say that they're just sort of raw feels, like there's just raw sensations. And that if you come on, you know, so I look out and I see a red napkin on a green table, you know, and a sort of old-fashioned picture here would be that there's just the raw feeling of seeing these colors and shapes, but there's no intentionality, and that only after I sort of form a belief about the world outside and the basis of this perception that you get something like intentionality. But, you know, increasingly philosophers just sort of question that dichotomy. So, for one thing, many philosophers now think that belief has a phenomenology. There is something it's like to be thinking something. There's something it's like from the inside to be thinking something. Something it's like maybe to desire something, right? So that these sorts of states can have a phenomenology, although there is an interesting, you know, debate about that, right? So. But anyways, in saying that there is a phenomenology to pleasure, we don't have to deny that maybe it is a kind of attitude. And I do think there's other reasons to think that it is a kind of attitude, which I'll get to in just a moment. So I want to say a little bit more, though, about what I mean by an attitude. So in saying that pleasure is an attitude, I mean something a little bit technical by attitude, right? So let's talk about belief and desire again. So these are often called propositional attitudes. Philosophers often call them that. And they say that because it's a relation to a proposition. So I have in the handout a nice example to help illustrate that. So it's, you know, number 5 on the back, 5A. So consider this sentence. John believes that there is a cookie in the cookie jar. And then look at 2. John desires that there is a cookie in the cookie jar. It's the same proposition, right? The same worldly state of affairs that it's believed in the first case and it's wanted in the second, right? So I might believe there's a cookie in the cookie jar because I put some in there earlier and I don't believe that anyone was around to take them out. So in believing that there's a cookie in the cookie jar, my belief is presenting the world as being a certain way, which either could really be that way, in which case the belief is true, or it may not be that way, in which case the belief is false, right? But I could also just want there to be a cookie in the cookie jar, maybe because I'm hungry, maybe because I like cookies, right? And here, it's the same proposition, right, that there's a cookie in the cookie jar, but it's not the same mental state, of course, and it's a different mental state. This is my way of introducing the notion of an attitude. It's the relation or attitude I take toward that proposition that distinguishes belief from desire. So we can believe and want similar propositions. The difference is in the relation you take towards them. And just to sort of flesh that out a little bit more, there's one common way of talking about this in terms of direction of fit. So it's often said that beliefs have a mind-to-world direction of fit. And what that means is that in believing something, the aim of belief is for my belief to match the way the world is. So if I believe there's a cookie in the cookie jar, and there really is a cookie in the cookie jar, then my belief fits that worldly state of affairs. We say the belief is true, and that's a good thing, right? So beliefs aim at matching belief. If my beliefs don't match the world, I should change my belief, right? So if I believe there's a cookie in the cookie jar, and then I open it, and there's not one, I now need to change my belief, right? But desire has the reverse direction of fit. So when I want there to be a cookie in the cookie jar, I'm not trying to fit the world with my desire. Rather, when I want there to be a cookie in the cookie jar, that motivates me to change the world. I'm not trying to get my desire to fit the world. I'm trying to get the world to fit my desire. So I want there to be a cookie in the cookie jar. There isn't one. And that motivates me to change the world by putting a cookie in that cookie jar, right? So desires have the reverse direction of fit, which I think is a really interesting sort of way to think about that. Like the pleasure's an attitude. Well, we saw one reason, which was this heterogeneity argument and thinking that the only thing that makes something a pleasure is the fact that you take a certain attitude towards it, the attitude of desire. But even if we don't think pleasure is reducible to desire, there's still good reason to think that it is an attitude and not just, say, a feeling, like a raw sensation. And that is that in pleasure, there's something that is light, right? So just as when you believe something, it makes sense to ask, what do you believe? And just as when you want something, it makes sense to ask, what do you want? Arguably, in an instance of pleasure, it's appropriate to ask, what is it that's pleasing? What is it that you like? And I guess if I wanted to flesh that out a little bit more, to sort of, because you, again, I think my old way of thinking, you might have thought it was a global, just a sensation. But think about, you know, one way I like to illustrate this is imagining, I mean, you could have a pain in your toe while getting a back massage and being fed chocolates. I don't know why this is the example that comes in my head. And it seems to me that I can, you know, I can feel, it's not as though there's just one state of how pleased am I right now. I have a pain that I'm sort of, that's pointing towards my toe, right? I have an experience that's negative directed towards my toe. As I taste the chocolate, I can find the chocolate to be pleasing. Maybe the back rub, maybe, you know, they press too hard and right now it hurts. Each of my experiences, there's sort of, I can take different attitudes of liking and disliking towards them, even at the same time, right? So I think there's one reason, again, to think, you know, again, the point of this is to say that pleasure has an object, just like belief has an object or desire has an object. By object, again, what I mean is that which one is liking or enjoying in the case of pleasure, or that which is one's believing or in the case of belief, or desiring in the case of desire. So I think we should think that pleasure is a attitude. Now, section 6 here, one question is whether pleasure is, in fact, reducible to desire, right? So those quotes that I had on the first page were also saying pleasure is an attitude, but reducing desire. So I've got three reasons that I wanted to discuss today about why I think it's a mistake to think that even though pleasure is an attitude, that it's desire. The first is that I don't know that desire always has a phenomenology, but sometimes it does. And the phenomenology of desire simply is not the phenomenology of pleasure. So, if anything, if I were to think about what it's like to want something, it could be intense, actually, a slightly negative feeling. So, maybe here's a good example is, you know, think about when you were a kid, and there was something you wanted really badly for Christmas. I want that. And it's slightly painful. Or maybe a painful longing, it is Valentine's Day again. Maybe you have a painful longing for a romantic, someone that you're romantically attracted to. That desire need not be pleasant at all. It feels quite different from pleasure. In fact, I think it can be negative. Now, that doesn't mean every desire has a negative phenomenology, but my point there is that if anything, pleasure has a phenomenon. I mean, I argue that pleasure is a phenomenology, but it's either desires don't have a phenomenology, or if they do, and I think they do, in fact, it's a different phenomenology than pleasure. So it doesn't make much sense, I think, to try to reduce pleasure to the phenomenology of desire. A second reason, let's see, I'm taking it. A second reason, I think, for thinking that pleasure can't, the attitude of pleasure isn't the same as desire, comes from some evidence from neuroscience and drug addiction. And I'm just going to gesture towards this right now, but there's a neuroscientist that I really like who's done some research on sort of the pleasure centers of the brain and also reward, what psychologists call reward. And he's found that with something he calls, and I put it in quotes here because he actually puts in quotes, he doesn't want to commit to it being the same thing as desire and pleasure, but what he calls wanting versus liking, he's found dissociations. And let me describe a little bit of what he's done. So one thing he's done is with rats, rats make faces, facial, their mouth makes a face that is shared across many species of animal, including humans. When they taste something that's pleasurable, they make a certain kind of face. And when you feed them something that's not pleasurable, like a really potent salt solution, they make a face that's of dislike. Okay, so this is an important fact about them because this, what Barrage has done is he's used that then as a way, of course you can't ask the rat, is this pleasant or is this unpleasant? But he looks at their facial expressions. And if you were to look up these articles, you'll find, you can look for photos of newborn babies and rats that make similar faces. What he's done is he's, through surgical intervention, he's able to directly stimulate the reward system in the brain in such a way that the rat is caused to intensely want a substance that it finds displeasurable. So, just to illustrate, you can have a rat that it knows that over here there's sugar substance that it likes, and then you have this highly salty saline solution, which is displeasurable to the rat. But by stimulating that area at the same time that the rat is exposed to the salt solution, the rat becomes, it avoids the sugar solution and it compulsively drinks the salt solution, which it makes faces of displeasure, and yet it continues to drink. It makes a face of disliking. And so we get a real dissociation. And this is, of course, through direct intervention in the brain. But the areas he's intervening on are regions of the brain that are triggered by dopamine. And so he's actually used this to develop a model of drug addiction as well. So, anecdotally, it's also the case, and this is very similar to what maybe is going on in these rats, is that someone who is addicted to drugs of addiction, I think all drugs of addiction, in fact, are ones that cause big spikes in dopamine. And what can happen is that an addict can come to no longer get pleasure from the drug, even though they want it badly, right? And so again, we get a dissociation between wanting and liking. So in other words, the point of this is to say that it's just not true, some of these things that are not necessarily true, some of the things written on the first page. So, for example, Heathwood's saying that sensation is pleasure if the subject desires it intrinsically in de re. You might think that we have a counterexample here, right? So that there's a subject can want to have a certain sensation, although that's a slight leap because we don't know if it's a sensation that's wanted in these cases. You can have wanting here without any pleasure, without any liking. You can get what you want and not feel pleasure. Finally, one last reason why I think it's a mistake to assume that the attitude of pleasure is that of desire is what we can call the Euthyphro problem for desire-based views. Going back to Plato's Euthyphro, he uses a different example. This is something that actually comes up in many places in philosophy. So we can ask the question, do I want the chocolate because it is pleasing, or is it pleasing because I want it? And even advocates of the desire-based views admit this, that the intuitive answer to that question is the first horn of that dilemma, right? I want the chocolate because it's pleasing. If it wasn't pleasing, I wouldn't want it. It seems backwards to say that it's pleasing because I want it. It seems like I want it because it's pleasing. I think this is extremely intuitive. I mean, it's, you know, imagine trying a new fruit that you've never had before. Maybe you're in another country and they have a unique fruit you've never had, and you're going to eat it. You don't want it yet, although you might be curious. So you want it, you know, in an abstract sense, you want to try it. You taste it. If you experience pleasure, that might make you want to eat more. And that seems like the right order of explanation. The alternative, if you had this view that pleasure is reducible to desire, then you'd have to say that it's being a pleasure is actually grounded in the fact that I want to be having that experience, rather than the other way around. Okay, so that's one more reason to think that although pleasure should treat it as an attitude because it has an object, this attitude is distinct from desire, although maybe it has a similar direction of fit to desire. I got plenty of time, I guess. So one last question that I want to think about concerns the objects of pleasure. So I've said that pleasure is an attitude directed toward an object. I've been speaking, I hopefully I did this consistently, I'm not sure, but I've been acting as though the objects of our likings are things like chocolate or pizza or things like that, and actually that is my view. But there's another possibility. You might think that the object of pleasure, that which is most immediately liked, is not something like a piece of chocolate or a slice of pizza or a back rub or any of those sorts of things, but rather the experience you have when you taste the chocolate or the experience you have when you eat the pizza or the experience you have when you get a back rub, but not the back rub itself, right? So in other words, you might think that we might ask, what is the immediate object of pleasure? What is the thing that we are liking? Is it something internal, like a sensation or experience? Or is it the external thing, which our sensory experiences may be acquainted with? When I first thought about this question, I was really pretty sure that I would have thought it's something internal, and after thinking about it, I changed my mind. There's a couple arguments I considered that I'm not going to talk about for thinking that it has to be something internal, and I think those fail. But if you attract to that view, I'd be happy to talk about it later. So I'm just going to give a few reasons, positive reasons, for thinking that it is something external. Admittedly, this is a little bit hand-wavy, I think. First is that arguably the biological function of pleasure is to draw us toward external things that are beneficial to the organism or the organism's reproductive success. I mean, why is sugar pleasant? Because we need it, right? Because it's caloric. Why do we like high-fat foods? Again, it's really high-dense calories, which would have been highly advantageous for us to eat whenever they're available in our sort of evolutionary niche. Unfortunately, now they're so widely available that we keep eating them, we can't help it. So I think the function of pleasure is to draw us towards that which is beneficial to us. And of course, what's beneficial to us is something external. So if we thought that what pleasure was really directing us towards was something like a sensation, we'd have to give a more complicated story. It'd have to be that pleasure, it aims us towards external things, but only by first directing us towards internal things, and then there has to be some kind of process of inference or association between an internal state and an external thing. It seems like an unnecessarily complicated story. Related to that, actually, so there's the second thing on the handout there, is that it makes sense of the way in which pleasure can motivate and rationalize action. So what do I mean by that? Well, if you taste something that's pleasurable, that might motivate you to eat it again. And we consider that to be a good reason, right? So the fact that you found something pleasing can function as a reason why it's rational for you then to do it again, all things considered. So what's motivated, presumably, so in other words, whatever pleasure's object is what is sort of the primary thing that we're motivated or rationalized whenever it's rationalized. And so intuitively, what's rationalized are certain actions or interactions with external objects. Again, if you said that the object of pleasure was something internal, we'd have to tell a much more complicated story where you have to make an inference, like, since I like the experience I'm having when I eat the salsa, then that gives me a reason to eat the salsa only in conjunction with my belief that if I eat the salsa, I'll have another one of those experiences, which I like. This very complicated bit of, maybe it's automatic and unconscious reasoning, would have to be, you'd have to endorse that, I think, if you thought the immediate object was something internal. And finally, and maybe this is the best, reason, is that if the objects of pleasure were internal states, such as sensations, then presumably pleasures would, to have pleasure of that sort would require some capacity to represent one's own states of mind, such as your sensations. But it's it's unclear, that young children or non-human animals have that capacity, that they have the capacity to form representations about their own internal mental states. So they may have mental states that represent things in the world through perception, for example, but they may not have mental states for their own experiences, right? Their own visual experiences. That's a sort of cognitive achievement that comes much later. But surely, I think, non-human animals, some of them, and young children are capable of experiencing pleasure and displeasure. And so we shouldn't have a view that requires that they have some sort of complicated representational capacity beyond what we have reason to think they have. My last section, and here I've left it open. So this is really going to be food for thought, and I'm glad I did make it through all this, because the big picture of this, the thing that I think is exciting, is to then think about the value of pleasure and also what I've said about the objects of pleasure. So another thing that I think is a bit mysterious about the feeling type view, the distinctive feeling theory of pleasure, which treats pleasure as just a raw sensation, a certain kind of good feeling. Even though, again, I think if you asked me 2 years ago, I would have thought that, and I would have then gone on and thought this, which maybe you would think this too, because which is that there's a certain kind of feeling, pleasure, and whenever a person has it, that's good for them. Now, of course, there's big debates about whether pleasure is the only thing that's good. That's a hedonism about well-being. But even if you're not a hedonist, even if you think that there's lots of other things that are valuable in life besides pleasure, almost everyone agrees that pleasure is a good thing. And in fact, even more so, I think people agree that usually pain or displeasure is a bad thing for you, right? So that we would all maybe prefer to be in states of pleasure than displeasure. But on the feeling, if you were to ask why, I think the answer on that sort of view is, well, there's just no answer. So it's just intrinsically good. There's a certain bit of phenomenology, the feeling of pleasure, and it is just good for me to have. And if you ask why, the answer is, it just is. It's just primitively good. There's no structure in this picture to say why it's good. You just have to say it is. And I find that a bit mysterious. Now, of course, any explanation here is going to have to start from something. But what does the picture look like on the story I've been telling? There's another kind of value on the attitude view, which is that just as, and we might now, I'm going to switch to desire and think about an analogy with desire. So when I want something, suppose I want a piece of chocolate, there's a sense in which the chocolate is now at least subjectively valuable to me because I want it. I've made it valuable. And of course, I am being speculative and sticking my neck out in this controversial area here, but it becomes valuable because I want it. And likewise, similarly, you might think that pleasure makes its object a thing of value for the one who is pleased. that values conferred onto the objects of desire and values conferred onto the objects of pleasure. And here, the kind of value I'm talking about is subjective values, or prudential value, some contribution to how, whether things are going well for me in a subjective sense. So you might think of pleasure and desire as valuational states, that they have as their target something which is made valuable by my wanting it or by my liking it. And so we have some structure here to account for there being value in pleasure, but the value on this picture is that pleasure makes its object valuable for the pleased. Now, this all, again, I think it makes a lot of sense, but what about pleasure itself? Well, in the case of desire, it seems as though when I want something, that thing that I want is made valuable for me. But it would be weird to say that the desire, my wanting, is also valuable for me. If, you know, there seems to be no intrinsic value in my wanting something. The value here is in the thing that is wanted. And I'm tempted now to say something similar about pleasure. That pleasure makes its object valuable. And it can do that without it being valuable. This is very counterintuitive, I think, right? So we normally think that just feeling pleasure is itself good for me. But I'm suggesting it, I sort of raising the question why I think that. It will seem like when I'm pleased, and then there's something I have that is valuable because I like it. And that's, why not stop there, right? So there's no need in this picture to say the pleasure itself is valuable. Maybe I'll leave this for Q&A, but there's a lot of, there's some counterintuitive consequences of that. So in the reverse case, pain. So I would give a similar view of a theory about pain. So pain or displeasure in the case of, there's a lot of, think about nausea, it's not really a pain, but it's the opposite of pleasure, right? It's displeasure. I would argue that when you experience displeasure, the object is a thing of negative value for you. And we can say that without saying that the displeasure itself has negative value. Maybe I'll leave it there. I'm curious what you think about that, about whether pain and pleasure have value in themselves or whether they just make their objects valuable. All right, thanks.
Okay, now it's time for our Q&A, so who would like to have the first
question? I got a question. How much is pain or pleasure a motivation? I mean, you kind of spoke about it in the abstract, but I'm just wondering, why do we do anything?
Yeah. Well, good. So, first of all, I do think that if we didn't have pain or if we didn't have pain, pleasure, and we also didn't have desire, it's quite possible we wouldn't do anything at all, right? So that, but when we talk about the direction of fit of belief and desire, that's one of the things about desire, at least, is that it seems to be motivational. And it also seems, observing behavior, I mean, it seems that pleasure is also motivational, and pain is. So here's the view I'm attracted to about that. So, which is that, it's part of the normal functional role of pleasure to, and this is where I said at the very beginning that pleasure sort of tells us what to want. So when something's pleasurable, it raises what Berridge, the neuroscientist that I was mentioning before, would say the incentive value or the incentive value of the thing that's pleasing, and so then that makes you want it. And wanting has this sort of motivational force. I guess my feeling is that pleasure is not directly motivational, except that it makes us want things, which then is motivating. And likewise, pain. An intense pain you know, obviously it's highly motivational. So when you feel enormous pain, and quite unthinkingly, actually. So there could be some slight, I think there could be some asymmetries between pain and pleasure in that sense, because I think pain certain kinds of pains sort of seem to directly motivate action in a way that seems quick and not as mediated as pleasure. Whereas pleasure, it's not as though I taste something delicious. I mean, maybe occasionally, but this is, and then I just immediately have to start, can't control myself, right? Whereas pain, if you were in agonizing pain, you might not be able to do anything but attend to the pain or do something in a certain way.
That's interesting.
I'm trying to form the question right now.
Yeah.
Evolutionarily speaking, pleasure may have important functions. We get pleasure from the things that do us good, that make us better in some way. We get pain from the things that hurt us, injure us, whatever like that. And yet we have attached these things to things that intrinsically don't have this ability to harm or help us. And modern market capitalism has made us have at least desire for a lot of things that intrinsically are not valuable to us. How is it that we can expand our needs so hugely?
Yeah, I love that question. Yeah, well, go ahead. I think it's a fantastic question. I can't answer it completely. I mean, not even close to completely. And it's partly it's an empirical psychological question. I mean, but one thing that I think is as a starting point, it does make sense from an evolutionary perspective. This so that for example, learning what you should eat and what you shouldn't eat. So as best as I've been able to tell, it looks like children they don't have to learn to like sweetness, for example. But they do have to learn to like a lot of foods. And in fact, there's a lot of foods that if you didn't grow up eating them, you may not like them. But if you've grown up eating them at a certain age, you do. So I hear cilantro as an example of that. So some people do not like cilantro. And it has, it probably might depend on exposure at a certain age. So there's this capacity to, from an evolution perspective, even if we stuck with only brute sensory experiences, without even thinking about the bigger stuff, which I think is even, I'm hoping we can look at this and that will help shed light on the more complicated example. So I would think, one thought is that there is some kind of associative mechanism where, you associate something you already like with something else that you don't yet like, but then it can somehow spread, and that would help you, first of all, learn to like certain foods. So there's some kind of thing like that can happen. So I think, obviously, you're right. I mean, we've so many of the things that we want, so I stick to sort of sensory experiences, because those examples are easier to sort of to get a grip on, but we want so many things. I mean, what someone might say, they might say you want it because you anticipate getting pleasure from it, and we do get pleasure, from things in that way, but yeah, there's got to be some process by which you start. I mean, the way I'm thinking about it is we start with some basic set of things that we're sort of wired to like, and there has to be some psychological process by which you sort of learn to like other things, and it might be partly through association of some sort, and the fact that it could then, we could reach the point where we want things like, we just want a fork. Why do I want a fork? You can give a story, but yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, yeah, so I don't have an answer to that question. It's a really great question. I mean, the whole detail of how that works, especially when it gets to sort of cognitive, desires or cognitive pleasures.
Okay, I've got one. In thinking about desire and pleasure as attitudes toward phenomena, it makes me think of certain Buddhist teachings that advocate taking an attitude of equanimity and acceptance toward all phenomena.
Yeah.
And would that
would that be a different category of an attitude, or would that be a non-attitude?
Oh, yeah, except that's a good question, because my understanding is that, say you have like a chronic pain and you sort of, you know, come to accept it in some way. I think the goal, and I don't know enough about Buddhism, but the goal is to alleviate suffering in some way by this act of somehow coming to accept it, sort of observe it and either detach or accept it. So to the extent that you're reducing suffering, you're reducing displeasure. When I imagine what that's like, I don't know that it would then convert into a pleasure. I think acceptance is probably a more complicated cognitive state, but the goal of acceptance might be to reduce suffering. And what I think suffering here does mean displeasure, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. So the thought is that by taking this stance towards your experience, you can somehow reduce things that suffer. But I don't think they would thereby become a pleasure. And so this gets to another interesting issue, which is whether every experience is in some ways infused. So one thought is that pleasure or displeasure and attached to experiences, but they don't have to, so you can have an experience that's just completely neutral. And I do think we might have experiences that are neutral, but I don't know that that means that they're not evaluated. So you know, one possibility would be that even sort of a, you know, I like to think about imagining, so imagine something that's just barely, imagine a saltless saltine, and you're not hungry, but you're also not full, and you just eat it. And it's like, you know, is that pleasurable? Is it it's not displeasurable, maybe. It might be faintly pleasurable, but then imagine you are sort of drinking a glass of water with no flavor, and you're not thirsty, but you're also not waterlogged, and it could be in a state that's neither pleasurable nor displeasurable, but it may be that, you know, one possibility is that every experience just sort of goes through an evaluative filter of some sort. So that even these states that are neutral, that are neither pleasure nor displeasure, are sort of positively evaluated as neutral, so as opposed to being sort of not evaluated at all, so to speak.
That sounds about right, because one of the phrases used is one taste, and that seems to be kind of like what you're saying, that everything, you know, can be evaluated as a taste that in itself, you know, is pleasurable, but in a way that maybe transcends a polarity between a negative taste and a positive taste.
I don't have an argument for this. I do have a hunch that sort of every experience is sort of evaluated in some way, even if it's barely, or it comes out as neutral, perhaps. It's also an interesting question about whether, to what extent we can change the valence, you know, the positive or negative value of an experience through at some, you know, meditation or some other technique is an interesting question.
Nobody else said that. I actually have another one.
Yeah.
I would guess that your thesis is agnostic as to ethical implications, because utilitarianism would say that, you know, you can define ethics as promoting pleasure and you know, suppressing pain.
Yeah.
But there's not necessarily in your thinking a value, an ethical valuation of pleasure. Is that right?
Yeah. So I have been thinking about things in the ethical domain, but not about sort of what you might call moral value, sort of value that determines sort of right and wrong action, but at least in terms of well-being. So what contributes to your well-being? And of course, a famous view that's widely contested and out of fashion to mostly these days, but has some advocates, is It's called hedonism. So hedonism about well-being. And hedonism about well-being says that pleasure and the absence of pain are the only things that contribute to your well-being. And I have been somewhat attracted to hedonism. What I'm sort of interested in is, what does hedonism look like on this view? So it ends up looking not like hedonism. But there's a view in the ballpark of hedonism, but in any ways, which would be that pleasure and pain are the only source of value, but the value that exists in this way is not the value in the experience of pain and pleasure itself, as a hedonist, sort of a traditional hedonist would say, but rather the objects of value, the objects of pleasure, the objects of displeasure, they have their positive and negative values. So that means that my well-being is determined by my having the objects of pleasure, not in my being in the middle state of pleasure itself. My being in the middle state of pleasure is what makes those objects the things that would make things go well for me. I'm a little tempted by a view like that, although I'm not sure pleasure and pain are the only things that contribute value. One thing that's interesting is that this sort of view doesn't have the problem of the what's called the experience machine objection to hedonism. So there's a famous thought experiment by Robert Nozick in 1974, I think. The philosophers sort of considered a knockdown refutation of hedonism, and that was the experience machine, where you could plug into a machine that gives you a sort of a virtual reality sort of experience for the rest of your life, which maximizes pleasure. So maybe each of us would have a different simulation, but imagine some course of life experiences that would be maximized pleasure for you, plug into the machine for the rest of your life, and you could have that. And what a lot of philosophers thought about that is that, was Nozick's point, which is that that doesn't seem like the best thing to do. It doesn't seem like we wouldn't choose to plug into the machine. We value connected to reality or something like that. So one thing is that, like, on this view, if pleasure and pain are the source of value, what they make valuable are their objects. But in the case of being an experience machine or being in some kind of, like, in the Matrix, a movie like the Matrix, the things that you're liking are actually not present. They merely seem to be, right? So in case of hallucination. So one of the possibly counterintuitive, but in this case it turns out to be a beneficial consequences of this view, if I did say this about value, is that it merely seems like you have something of value when you hallucinate that you're eating chocolate. Because the thing that's valuable in this case is the apparent chocolate. And the apparent chocolate actually doesn't even exist in this case. And so you're actually not benefited. It seems like you are. You'll think you are, but you're not. Now, the flip side of that for pain is a bit shocking, though, because so this is, which would mean that if you've suffered great pain in a hallucinatory manner, there's nothing bad. It just seems like there's something bad. And most people will find that a bit counterintuitive. But I'm starting to find it less counterintuitive the more I think about it.
Anyone else? Well, if not, we'll call it night.
Thanks. All right.